All right, hello and welcome to From the Diamond. I am Grant McCauley. Not in the Kia studios today. We are out at Murph's at the Galleria. It is All-Star Weekend. It's a big, big week, really, of baseball here at the Battery area and beyond, as we are, again, over at the Galleria. There's a huge fan village that's been set up here. I got a chance to walk through and look at that some yesterday. Absolutely tremendous. If you have, I don't know, anywhere between 2 and 6 hours to kill, you'll find some pretty good stuff to do. If you're just looking for the best baseball entertainment that you can find, well, there's a huge lineup of it that's been going on all weekend. We had the Futures game yesterday. That was first one of those I've been able to go to in person, so pretty neat to be able to do that. And then on top of that, there was a celebrity softball game last night. I think that airs on tape delay. I'm not really sure. But either way, if you're into the celebrity softball thing, you're able to scratch that itch. And then we've got the Major League Baseball draft, something we're going to talk about a lot on this edition of From the Diamond as we try to kind of count down, kind of get you ready for what is not the usual draft kind of show that you'll typically hear here on 92.9 The Game, because the thing with the Major League Baseball draft, of course, is you don't necessarily see these guys for a year, 2 years, 3 years, sometimes longer. I mean, in the case of Grant Holmes, he was a first-round pick and then spent 10 years in the minor leagues, but found his way to the bigs with the Braves last year and has been a great story, a very, very good pitcher for them this year. So you never know what winding road it will take you to get to Major League Baseball and to, you know, live the dream, as it were. But for a multitude of kids over the next few days, that dream is going to begin, which is a very exciting thing. We got a lot to get into on this edition of From the Diamond. I want to remind you, as always, you can follow me on social at Grant McCauley is where you can find me on most platforms. You can like the show on Facebook. Just search for From the Diamond there. And if you need links to all the stuff I've got going on, FromTheDiamond.com is a great place for that. And, of course, I'd be remiss not to tell you, if you want to connect with the show the best way, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and find it on the Odyssey app. If you do subscribe, it'd be so nice to leave a rating. That would also be very much appreciated. So the Braves are in the midst of trying to wrap up the first half as they stopped over in St. Louis to take on the Cardinals. And I would say this first half is going to be pretty straightforward when it comes to trying to just, sum it up, if you will. I think the word is probably frustration for the Braves. There was a lot of that, some disappointment for the Braves who weren't able to live up to their expectations or what the fans had set out for them. And it really, if you look at the overall prognostication before the season, the Braves were expected to be one of the best teams in Major League Baseball, and it simply has been anything but that thus far. So the question, I guess, it comes to is, how did they get here? And the answer to that is, well, a few things conspired against them, but the number one thing and the most baffling thing for this Braves club, and if you've listened to this show or really any other discussion about the Braves over the past 3+ months, where did the offense go? How did this club go from being the team that it was a couple of years ago to a team that is now 24th in Major League Baseball in runs scored? I mean, the Braves have got to figure out a way to get more offense going if they want to make the most of the rest of their season. But now the next question, obviously, that comes this way is there enough time left for the Braves to really make much of this season? And I think that the jury's out in the traditional sense. It may be too late for the Braves to make a playoff run. I think that people are starting to come to terms with that over the past couple of weeks, because if there was a time to really make up for the hole that they dug themselves into in the first, month and a half, 2 months of the season, it was a very, I think, workable part of the schedule that was going on in mid-May to early June. And the Braves were unable to take advantage of playing some teams that were well under 500. And in doing that, I think they dug a bigger hole because they fell from under 500 and stayed there and are there right now. The worst first half for the Braves since 2016. It's not what anybody had on their, I think, bingo card for how this team, based on the talent and based on the expectations, was going to play this year. But it kind of is what it is for them. And one of the reasons why, in addition to the offense not being able to score the runs, which has caused a lot of close games, a lot of winnable games to slip through their fingers, then you start to lose major components on your pitching staff. You go back and look at the Braves' opening day roster. They have lost 4 of their 5 starting pitchers. That is difficult for any team to be able to overcome. And we're not talking about just any 4 starting pitchers either. We're talking about Chris Sale, the reigning Cy Young Award winner. We're talking about Spencer Schwellenbach, who is putting together a season that I think would have had him at the All-Star game had his elbow injury not occurred a couple of weeks ago. And then you lose A.J. Smith-Shawver on top of that. A nice, you know, young up-and-comer who really seemed like he was going to be able to help the Braves out, because if you really flash back to the first road trip of the season, that's when the Braves lost Ronaldo Lopez, who was an all-star last year. So four of your five starters go down. I don't care really which club you are. And I mean, I think the Dodgers might be the only exception to this rule because they signed 14 starting pitchers coming into the year. But it's hard to overcome that. Like the organizational depth to deal with losing 80% of your starting rotation, there aren't too many teams out there that are going to be able to do that. But where the team goes from here is going to be a fascinating exercise, because I really feel like if you look at the Braves, traditionally speaking, and especially over the last, 7 years, and the trips to the playoffs that they've taken, the World Series title in 2021, when you're sitting here at the All-Star break, nobody's talking about selling. Nobody's thinking about selling if you're the Braves. And there were a couple of years, including 2021, where it was heavily suggested on social media that the Braves might want to start selling off all the pieces, breaking it down, rebuilding the farm, and so on. And all they did was go on to win the World Series. And that may not be the script in 2025. It does not feel like that's the script in 2025, based on some of the personnel issues that they're dealing with. But with 10 games to go before the deadline, I think we kind of know the way that this Braves team is trending. But it is wild to see the way that the season played out on those multiple fronts that I talked about, based on the offensive futility and, of course, the injuries to the pitching staff, which puts more tax on the bullpen, which was already, I think, a little bit undermanned with the losses of some key relievers that weren't made up for over the winter. So I think a lot of things kind of conspired against the Braves this year. But I think I found the quote that describes the Braves offense the best that I know how to describe it. This lineup has been a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. And that is the great Winston Churchill, who also dropped this odd pearl, which was war is hell. And the Braves have to feel like that a little bit because of how much they've had to go through over the course of this year, just to kind of get where they are. There's some win-loss records I think Atlanta would like to attain before the end of this season, but I'm just not sure that they're going to be possible. And here's a couple of them, the numbers that it's going to take to get there, because baseball, unfortunately, even though there's that emotional, that physical component, that everyday competition that comes together, eventually it will come down to the numbers, and of course working against time is where the Braves are now. If they want to get back to 500, they've got to go 39-29 in the second half. That's a .570 winning percentage. And the Braves right now, as they try to wrap up their series in St. Louis, have been 10 games under .500. And I don't know if the rain is going to let them get this particular series in St. Louis done, because what a cruel twist. You know, and not ironic, I guess, in the way that the season has not gone according to plan, to have to sit through a long rain delay in their final game of their final series of the first half. But if the Braves want to get to 500 in the second half, they're going to have to basically play 10 games over the rest of the way. If you want to shoot for that mythical 89 wins in the playoff spot that I think would come with that, well, the Braves would have to play almost 700 baseball down the stretch, and this just does not feel like a group that has the necessary pieces in place. And I don't think that there are the pieces out there in trade that are going to turn the tide completely for this club. And you kind of have to look at this year as, what do you want to invest here and what do you want to invest in moving into the future? The Braves have got to sort all that out. Alex Anthopoulos is in a weird position, one that I don't think that he knows altogether too well. Now, outside of 2021, which I know a lot of people go and they run to that and they look at that and they think, okay, well, you never know. And that's true. You know, until they're mathematically eliminated, I guess we don't know. But it is going to be difficult for the Braves to climb out of this hole when you consider just how far back they are in the division and just how many teams are ahead of them in the wild card. If you were going to tell me that heading into the middle of July that the only teams the Braves would have a better record than are the Pirates, the Nationals, and the Rockies, I would have needed to see the math. And now I've seen the math, and I'm looking at the math for the teams that are ahead of the Braves in that wild card, and it's, what, eight different teams, plus you got three division winners on top of that. So how do you get past what amounts to basically 11 other contenders in front of you for a wild card spot? If you want to say the final wild card spot, eight or nine teams are in front of you. And they're not all going to lose on the same day, because some of them are going to end up playing each other down the stretch. And that's going to make it even more difficult for this club. And some people have asked, you know, on social media, as I told you, you can follow me at Grant McCauley is where you can find me on there. If you have questions, I'll do my best to answer them. But this has been a season with not as many answers as questions. But I think the question that I have gotten is, well, do they really want to win at this point? Would it not be better for the team to just, you know, pack it in and try to get a higher draft pick? Well, I guess that could be something worth considering if you start looking at the odds, which coming into the weekend, the Braves had the fourth best odds for the number one overall pick in 2026. That is also not something I thought that I would be saying in July here of 2025 on the night of the Major League Baseball draft, no less. But do they really want to win? Yes. If you ask this club, do they want to win? You're going to get that answer every single time. Would it be more fruitful if this season died on the vine the way that some have suggested, sooner than later, if they continue to struggle? Well, perhaps. But nobody's going to say that. Nobody's looking to pack it in, but they continue to get hit by injuries. They continue to deal with inconsistencies in different parts of the game. And those two things together have conspired against the Braves this year to the point where it's just difficult to see the direction for this club. And Austin Riley was the latest one here on the road trip in St. Louis right before the break, dealing with an abdominal strain. Hopefully that's something that, between missing the rest of the series in St. Louis and the All-Star break, we'll have him back sooner than later. But there is no real time frame, I don't think, that's been put on that as of yet. And I haven't heard any real in-depth comments about it, and we may not until the Braves and Yankees meet on Friday at Truist Park when the second half gets going. But what are we going to see in the next couple of weeks as the trade deadline gets here? I think a very different approach for the Braves than we have seen in recent years, because they may finally sell off some pieces, whether that be Marcell Ozuna, whether that be Raisel Iglesias, whether that be Pierce Johnson, whether it be somebody else. And we'll get into some of the different trade scenarios and the pros and cons of trading certain players, because there have been some conversations over the last couple of weeks that I don't think have been quite as fruitful if you follow the Braves in terms of just how much you want to tear down, just how much you want to trade away. I think the frustration has set in, obviously, for a lot of folks, because when you've watched this team day after day after day after day, it has felt like a very similar fate, unfortunately, and they're just not able to score the runs they need to just give them some breathing room. Before the Chris Sale injury, the Spencer Schwellenbach injury, and now the Austin Riley injury, maybe you felt a different way about how this club was set up for a stretch run. Now, as you look at it, it's just a different equation, and the Braves are going to have to figure out some things on the pitching staff side that we'll also be talking about as we continue on from the diamond. But we got a lot of great stuff to jump into on this edition of the show. We'll dive into this week in Braves baseball, really this half in Braves baseball, if you will. We'll wrap up the first half. We're also going to talk about all things All-Star Week here in Atlanta. There is a very, very busy weekend here of events. We've got the Major League Baseball draft happening on Sunday. Going to have a couple of special guests to help me break that down. And we are also going to have the Home Run Derby on Monday. Not going to get Ronald Acuna Jr., but Matt Olson, a longtime resident of Atlanta, grew up a Braves fan, and attended the Home Run Derby in 2000. Could he win this thing? That would be quite the story. We'll talk a little bit about that, and we'll take our trip around the big leagues as well as we get ready for the All-Star Game happening on Tuesday at Truist Park. But right now, we are out at Murph's. Come by and see us in the Galleria. We'd love to say hi. We'll continue talking Braves and Major League Baseball and All-Star and all things beyond as we continue. This is From the Diamond with Grant McCauley on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game. And welcome back into From the Diamond with Grant McCauley live from Murph's at the Galleria on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game. We have branched out. We are enjoying all the sights and sounds of the All-Star festivities this weekend. Of course, building up to the Major League Baseball draft, which is happening this evening over at the Roxy. It'll get started with the early round magic, if you will. Maybe it'll be magic. We'll find out with exactly who goes where and when, and then, of course, we'll break it all down for you. But before we get to that, we're going to have some good preview stuff coming up. I've got Matt Powers of Battery Power to join me. I've also got Gaurav Vadak of Baseball Prospectus, who is live here at Murph's. We're going to maybe figure out who the Braves could be targeting with their first pick of the draft. That's number 22, if you're keeping score at home. We'll get into all of that. And then, of course, Home Run Derby is happening on Monday. We've got the All-Star Game itself happening on Tuesday. So lots to get into when we get back to the All-Star stuff. But I felt like leading off with what's been going on for the Braves, or unfortunately what's not been going on for the Braves, is the unfortunate trend of the first half of baseball for this club. The Braves' offensive disappearing act has been, I think, the top story for this team. One-run losses are really the difference in these games. So if you look at the Braves as they came into Sunday, I believe 10 games under 500, they're 13-23 in one-run games. Obviously, you flip that thing around, they're better in one-run games. They scored, what, a couple of more runs a night? in those particular instances, then you would be looking at a club that could be 10 games over 500. Doesn't work that way. We've been kind of living in this what-if space for a while. But it's not that the Braves needed to be, you know, scoring 40 or 50% more runs than they are right now, as they're, as said, 24th in Major League Baseball in runs scored. But if you just scored a couple of more runs here or there, it could have made a profound difference in all of these close games, the winnable games that the Braves have had. Their frustrations on Sundays are well documented because that's when I do the show. And the Braves have not been able to win a Sunday game in, this is 7 weeks now. So will the Braves be able to snap that seven-game Sunday losing streak for me? We'll find out maybe a little bit later as they're going to try to get back in action against the Cardinals up in St. Louis. But those one-run games are one thing. The seven-game losing streak at the beginning of the season, if you just do some quick and simple, just dirty math for this team, it was hard to climb out of that hole to begin with. That's just not the way you want to start the year. You knew it was going to be tough because the Padres and the Dodgers are both teams that have their eyes on October as well. And the Braves went 0-7. And that road trip really was more demoralizing because it wasn't just losses on the field, but you lost Ronaldo Lopez after one start. Jurickson Profar got an 80-game suspension for PEDs right off the top. I mean, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but it couldn't start much worse than it did, obviously, for the Braves. And, in fact, they have been, until their one win against the A's in Sacramento this week, they were 0 for California. And now they are 1-12 out in California. Not particularly good was the Braves' trips out there to play both the Dodgers and the Padres, the Giants, and then the A's ultimately as well. But that seven-game losing streak at the start of the year, that was going to be tough to climb out of to begin with. But there were really, to me, two stretches that just buried this team, two stretches of bad baseball beyond just losing seven in a row because, as we know, the Braves were able to climb back to 500, get a game over 500 in the middle of May. And then somehow, in what should have been, I think, a more favorable stretch of the schedule, they played some of their worst baseball of the season as they continued to lose to sub-500 clubs, teams that came into Truist Park on losing streaks and somehow got right against the Braves when you were hoping that the Braves would keep their momentum going and continue the miseries of these other clubs. It just didn't happen. And then they could turn around and sweep the Mets on that series heading into, what, June the 20th or June the 19th, whenever it wrapped up. But you lose Chris Sale in the midst of that. And then you have the next six series after it. You don't win any of those series. Some of them were against some tougher opponents. Others, winnable games between the Braves and the opportunity to maintain some momentum, build some momentum, and get themselves just, again, out of the hole. We're not even talking about being able to climb into the favorable position of the National League East, because if you look at those standings, it's very difficult to picture the Braves being able to get there anytime soon. And really, as time is their biggest enemy at this point in the season, it's going to be pretty difficult. Braves playing their 95th game of the year on Sunday. They trail the first-place New York Mets as of the time of the show by 12 games. The Phillies are a half game out. Phillies have also had kind of a wonky first half, but if a wonky first half results in you being 13 games over 500, I guess they'll take it. But this is just not a race that the Braves have been able to assert themselves in really at any point. And then a week or 10 days ago, in the midst of some of the losing they did, the Miami Marlins passed the Braves in the NL East standings. So just a crazy thing to see with the way that some of this has played out. There's just no two ways about it. But the not scoring runs has been the real big issue for this club. But the two stretches of baseball, the one right after getting up to 500, over 500, then falling below, then that momentum swing that felt like you maybe were getting by sweeping the New York Mets at Truist Park, turned out to be anything but moving forward after that. But some of the things that have gone right for the Braves in the first half, there are a few. I told you if you'd stick with me, I'd get to them. Ronald Acuña Jr. is playing at an MVP level. It's unfortunate he's going to miss the home run derby. I know a lot of folks are kind of, it's hit or miss, really, because nobody wants to take any chances that it's going to mess with him, mess with his swing, or physically create a problem for him. There's no way around that. There's going to be a worry about that because Ronald has had to go through some significant injuries. You don't want to do anything to put him in danger of suffering anything else that's going to take playing time away from him. A big picture, though, he is playing great. He is going to play in the All-Star game. He was voted in to start. I know that means a lot to him. Heard him talk about it a couple of weeks ago, just Atlanta being a second home to him and his desire to spend his entire career here, which can be another discussion that we will get in later when the trade deadline stuff comes up, because there have just been some conversations around the Braves, and maybe it's just for clicks or for content generation, if you will, but just some conversations that I don't think are really built on much And I don't see Ronald Acuña Jr. certainly going anywhere, or the Braves getting to the point where they're going to start tearing this thing down anytime soon, despite the frustration of their season thus far. But what Ronald has done, and missing the first 49 games of the year and pushing himself into all-star starter, is impressive, and it just speaks to exactly how hard he worked to come back from his second ACL tear. As I mentioned at the top of the show, the rotation losing four starters from opening day. While Spencer Strider looks more and more like he's going to be fine, this rotation is just stretched so thin. So how are the Braves going to cover these innings? And how are they going to cover for rotation losses for another month or more for some of the major arms that could be back this year, and when will they be back this year? For Chris Sale, I think late August is probably the target if you're being optimistic about it. For Spencer Schwellenbach, I think it probably looks more like September, but we just don't know. There's a lot that's just unknown with his injury. It's a slight fracture of his elbow, but I don't know about you, the motion of pitching is not exactly the most natural thing, so what's it going to feel like when he starts to ramp up? So it could really just be a wait-and-see scenario for him, and will he be back this year? I just don't think that we know. We're not going to see A.J. Smith-Shaw ever again until probably, in my opinion, just doing the math, what, spring of 2027 seems pretty likely for him. And that's a real bummer because I felt like he was starting to show. And keep in mind, he came up way ahead of schedule a couple of years ago and was really starting to find himself. And now the Tommy John surgery has him on the sideline for a while. And Ronaldo Lopez could come back, but maybe he factors into the bullpen. Maybe that makes more sense for him, at least for the final month plus of the season, just to allow him to help out, because if the Braves do get into this trade deadline and some pieces do start to move, like Raisel Iglesias or Pierce Johnson or some other key reliever that some other club might be willing to pay a nice price for, you're going to have to figure out a way to cover the innings in the bullpen as well. And maybe Ronaldo Lopez could help out with that. Joe Jimenez is working his way back and could return to the club in the second half. That's his goal. We heard he might miss the entire season. That would be a silver lining, at least for the bullpen. But if there is a lot of change out there, how are the Braves going to cover some of those innings? It'll be just more questions for Alex Anthopoulos and company to figure out. But we saw Didier Fuentes brought up here, and I did want to talk about this because I feel like there was a lot of discourse around his promotion that just wasn't necessarily fair to him and was kind of indicative of where the Braves found themselves, which was having to push something well beyond what I think was the timeline that you would have ideally had for a talented young pitcher. He had made 7 starts, I believe, above A-ball before he was brought up to the majors. And if you watched him pitch, you could see that the stuff was there. But the experience factor was clearly not. And major league hitters, major league lineups, they're going to scout, they're going to figure things out. They're going to put you on the ropes, test you, and they're going to make you pay for your mistakes. And they did. I was okay with the first start, and I kind of understood the second start. But once you got to the third and fourth, it became pretty apparent that Fuentes, who I think does have a bright future, and I mentioned A.J. Smith-Shawver came up way too early a couple of years ago, maybe we see Didier Fuentes at some point again in 26 or 27 when he's had the time to really get those innings under his belt, because I think he has a chance to be a very special pitcher. But it just spoke to the desperation of where the Braves were when you lose Chris Sale and Spencer Schwellenbach. So I don't blame them for trying it, because it was a promotion that was built completely on talent and taking a shot. But it just simply did not work. And the longer he was up here, I think the more detrimental it was going to become to him. So hopefully he can get down to Gwinnett. He can get things sorted out there and get back on track. It's, again, got very good stuff and could be a factor. But where the Braves are going to go for innings in both the rotation and the bullpen over the remainder of the year, those questions I think we're going to be asking just about every day, just about every series, because you know they cannot continue to just throw bullpen games 2 times a week, or at least 1 time through the rotation on and on, because you've got Bryce Elder, you got Grant Holmes, you got Spencer Strider, and then you got a bunch of question marks there. If you start trading away some of the pieces of your bullpen, Aaron Bummer may be another name to keep in mind that some club might like to have. Even Rafael Montero, who's thrown pretty well over the past month. I mean, what are these chips going to look like for the Braves? How many of them will they cash in? Are they going to really look to cash in a lot of them? Or will they do kind of the trying to walk the razor's edge or sit on the fence and do a little buying and do a little selling? I don't know. It's going to be difficult for Alex Anthopoulos to figure it out, and he doesn't necessarily have to for the next week and a half, but this is going to start to come into focus as we go through the month of July. Now, Austin Riley landing on the IL with an abdominal issue is yet another blow to at least the club's psyche. His Sale and Schwellenbach weren't enough. Now you have to wonder about when you might get your third-place hitter back and what exactly he's going to be able to offer when he does come back. Nacho Alvarez getting a look at third base right now. I don't think that he's a long-term fit there. To me, he profiles more as a second baseman, like defensively speaking. I think he kind of got thrown into the fire last year as well because you remember Ozzie Albies missed so much time. Nacho didn't really get a good first look at the majors, but could he offer something from an on-base perspective, from a contact skills perspective, the kind of bats that maybe the Braves need a little bit more of? Maybe so. But I think you have to kind of wonder, what's the future of Ozzie Albies? And I didn't think I'd be wondering about that, at least not to the extent that I am here in what is his last guaranteed contract year. But Ozzie Albies has two more options for $7 million apiece. And I remember being told several times when he signed this contract that it was highway robbery by the Braves. And somehow by the end of the deal, you know, based on some of the things that you read, depending on where you go, that the Braves should be considering not picking him up, not picking up that option, and paying him the $4 million buyout. But then my question would be, who exactly are you going to get to play second base? Is it Nacho Alvarez? I don't know that I'm convinced. I think that the Braves, who should have some significant money to spend, and I know that's been a source of consternation all season long, but they should have a significant amount of money to spend in free agency or trades to augment the club heading into 2026. We'll see how all that plays out, though. We got a lot more Braves to talk about, but we're going to turn our attention to the MLB draft. When we come back, I'm going to be joined by Grav Vidak of Baseball Perspectives. We're going to talk about who the Braves could be targeting in the draft with their number one pick and a lot of other good stuff. That's coming your way next on From the Diamond with Grant McCauley on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game and the Odyssey app. Welcome back in to From the Diamond with Grant McCauley on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game. We are live at MERS at the Galleria. We're getting set for the MLB draft, which is happening at the Roxy here on Sunday night. It will be going on for a few days as a lot of names are going to get called, and the Braves are going to be calling a few of those names. In fact, I have it on good authority that they're going to call the 22nd name in the draft in the first round. And we're going to get into all of that and more with Grav Vidak of Baseball Perspectives, who joins me live and in person here at MERS. Grav, good to see you.
Good to see you too, Grant. Happy to be here.
Oh, well, you know, this is the only place I'd want to be, this being like the greater, is this the greater Battery area? It's at least the Atlanta area. We're not far away from it, just a stone's throw, as the story goes. And a stone's throw from Truist Park, right across the street, is the case where is the Roxy. That's where the draft is going to be happening tonight. I know you're excited about that. I know you've been doing a ton of work kind of pouring over these names. So I want to jump into a few things here with you about the Braves and their needs, because they have quite a few of them. And typically, if we're breaking it down for a Braves draft in the first round, we're usually talking about what pitcher they've taken. Mm-hmm. What direction do you think they're going to go this year, or is it a fluid situation because so much can change between number 1 and number 21 before they get to pick at number 22?
That's like a really good question. Just like last year, we saw Cam Caminiti drop all the way down for the Braves, and that was a very unexpected drop. I think it's really fluid. Obviously, we've seen the flaws in the Braves farm system in terms of the positional prospects, and we see the You see over the course of a season just how many arms it takes to get through a full season. Mm-hmm. So there's obviously pros for each one. Personally, I think it would behoove the Braves to really go with a positional player in the first round. There's a lot of talent available at 22, and whether you go prep or high school, there's very interesting and intriguing bats that can not only find themselves in the top 100 immediately, but they can turn around a franchise very, very quickly.
Well, let's kind of dive into some of the position players they could be looking at. And if we're looking, I think, at the number one position that most Braves fans, maybe the Braves themselves, I know they were looking over the course of the winter to try to upgrade the shortstop position. This mm-hmm. is not a knock on Nick Allen, who is a terrific defender, but the long-term answer at shortstop has not been there since Dansby Swanson left. Are there some shortstops out there that you could realistically see the Braves going after at number 22?
No, absolutely. And what's really intriguing is you both have immediate upside plays like Vejia Aloy out of Arkansas, who is pretty much the best player on the best team in the country up until the College World Series final.
Right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And he's someone with, you know, that hits the ball really hard, has really, really good bat speed. He plays a fantastic defensive shortstop, so it'd be nice to go from someone like Nick Allen to a Vejia. So that's always a very, very intriguing. And if the Braves want to maybe play the long game, you know, you have very interesting players locally. You know, Daniel Pierce out of Mill Creek, he's got a good hit tool and projects with really good power. You've got Ryan Mitchell out of Tennessee, who's right now committed to Georgia Tech, but he's someone that also has really good tools across the board. He's someone that can come in and you don't have too much risk with him because he does a lot of things really, really well. And then you have someone that, like Merrick Houston, who out of Wake Forest, who had a phenomenal year, but for some reason we're hearing lately that he's falling in the draft and he might be available at 22. And then you have someone who I'm probably the most interested in, and if you were available, then that would be Josh Hammond out of High Point, North Carolina. With Josh Hammond, you have someone with a really, really big bat. He's got phenomenal raw power. He's got really good speed. He's got a great arm, and whether he stays at short or not, he can also move over to third and play that really well. So you have, you know, a potential power-hitting shortstop that has good defense. Mm-hmm. And then he's also a two-way player. He's got a massive arm. He's got a great fastball and a really good slider. You know, someone that young at 18 years old, the command is always in question. It's not really something you worry about right now, but he's someone that has tons of intrigue on both sides of the ball, and it's going to cost a lot to get him out of that college commitment, but he's someone that you could really think about playing long-term and having a really huge impact.
Yeah, I want to circle back on some of the strategy that comes with the money that's paid and, of course, the bonus pool and how you try to work within those and have to work within those restrictions as well, and every club does. Chatting with Graham Vidak of Baseball Prospectus is joining me here at Murph's on From the Diamond right here on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game. We talked a little bit about some of the shortstops the Braves could be targeting and the draft in general. I don't need to tell you this, and most people listening obviously have seen this phenomenon, if you will, but you watch the NBA draft, you know, which happened not long ago, and you think, okay, well, I'm going to see that guy next year.
Mm-hmm.
You watch the NFL draft, and you think, oh, we just changed our franchise because we got X amount of player or this particular player in that first round, second round. We're going to, you know, see those immediate improvements, if you will, that those areas of needs are going to be addressed. And while there are, I think, those unicorn players, and there have been quite a few this year, that have made it up pretty quickly and from the draft, that's just not the way that baseball is. So it is very much the long game. So when a club is looking to fill a need, it really doesn't involve how quick can we get them to the major leagues as the number one question that a team is asking.
No, absolutely. It's something that, especially when it comes to the major league draft, most of these players aren't going to be playing in the big leagues within, now, you know, 4 to 5 years. You have prep players that might have the highest upside, and you're talking about 6 to 7 years. So it has to be something. It takes the difference between college and the minors, not just the majors, but college and the minors is already significant enough where the translation's huge. You look at positional prospects, you're going from metal bats to wood bats. Mm-hmm. You have the Cape Cod League, which takes the best hitters in college, but it's a very small sample size. So it's a huge, huge change to go from college or even high school to the minor leagues. And then, you know, the normal rate between minor leagues and the majors is so small. So you don't normally draft for a need. You always, you know, in my opinion, you always have to go best player available, the best player on your board. And sometimes that is going to be pitcher.
Yeah, and we've seen with the Braves that it has been. I think Cam Caminiti was the latest and greatest example of that. And you also think about how important it is to try to get the draft as right as you can every single year, because if you go through a couple of down years and have a couple of misses, and injuries can be a part of that as well. It's not just, hey, we don't know how to scout. It's you try to project players that are a long way, to your point, from the big leagues. And I kind of broke it down like this with people, like the best 1% of players in high school go play college. Mm-hmm. The best 1% of college players go play the pros. Let's call it high school and pro. We'll put them together. The best 1% of them become pros. The best 1% of the minor leaguers make it to the major leagues. Best 1% of major leaguers, well, they go to Cooperstown. That's pretty much the math of how this thing works. So when you come in to be drafted, you are a long way down the road or from your final destination, and there are a lot of important stops and boxes to check along the way. But it's tantalizing to think about these talents, what they could become, and, of course, what they could do for your franchise. So as we look at the Braves and their biggest needs, I think building system depth is a thing that we've noticed this year has been exposed. Now, I will stipulate that losing 4 starting pitchers, that's cruel and unusual. Most clubs are not going to be able to find a way to Band-Aid over that. For the most part, the offense, it hasn't been injuries, it's been lack of production, but wouldn't you like to have a couple of players that could come in and maybe spark you there? Drake Baldwin's a good example of somebody who could. He's unfortunately in a timeshare with another rather important player, but long story short, if the Braves want to start building some system depth, where do you think it is that they need to focus, and how do you feel like that affects their draft strategy in 2025 and beyond?
That's a really great question, and really I wish I had a more specific answer, but
it's a hard question.
When you look at the state of the farm system right now, the most glaring need is positional prospects. Outside of Augusta, you don't really have many of the Braves' top prospects in any of the everyday lineups.
And right.
especially when you're heading toward the trade deadline, you want these assets to potentially use to make your major league team better. Well, the Braves don't necessarily have that. Most of their big prospects are going to be your pitchers. You know, we've seen so many of them come up this year. Schwellenbach recently. These are massive assets that can change and alter your franchise. And when you just don't have that kind of depth, not only does it hurt your day in and day out on the farm, but then you're also missing things to be able to contribute to the big league teams when it comes into comes to the trade deadline itself.
Yeah, and we've seen Alex Anthopoulos, I think, work some miracles with the prospects that he has given up for the deals that he has been able to pull off. I mean, 2021, maybe it was several rabbits he pulled out of his hat, and he did not give up very much for it. If I remember correctly, Bryce Wilson may have been the biggest quote-unquote name that he gave up for the players that eventually turned the Braves into a World Series winner by the end of the year. Chris Sale for Vaughn Grissom. That's a trade I'm going to do every day of the week.
Absolutely.
Until I saw on Sunday. I don't think that the Olsen trade has given the Braves any reason to look back. I mean, Shea Langeliers is a nice catcher, but the Braves went out and got Sean Murphy. I think the Wilson Contreras aspect of it does bug some people, but I don't think that the Braves believed in him as a catcher, and they were thinking about getting Sean Murphy, so it felt like that's how trades work. You move one guy out, you bring another guy in that you like a little bit more. But long story short, it is important to both generate the talent that's going to be able to refill you at the big league level and to fill those holes, but also to be able to find some major league ready players that could help you in a given year win, go to the playoffs, and do all the things that folks like doing. Let's go a little bit big picture here. Chatting with Gaurav Vedak of Baseball Perspectives. He joins me here at Merce on From the Diamond with Grant McCauley on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game. Nationals have the number one overall pick. Who are a couple of names that they're trying to decide between as the clock is ticking, ticking, ticking? Even though they're not on the clock yet, they're running out of time to maybe make that final decision if they haven't already.
I think at the top of the list for them especially is going to be Cade Anderson, the left-handed pitcher out of LSU, big arm. He's someone that LSU really hinged
pitchers
on.
Pitchers from LSU, are those popular at 1-1?
They seem to be pretty good at this sport, right? Outside of Cade Anderson, really the biggest one is going to be Ethan Holliday, whose brother recently got drafted, whose father played in Major League Baseball. He's got that lineage. You also have someone like Seth Hernandez, who's a really intriguing high upside arm out of California. But really, I think it's going to be those main three players with Cade Anderson leading the way for the Nationals.
It's going to be intriguing to watch because Major League Baseball's first round for so long was determined purely by the reversal of the previous year's record. How do you feel like the idea of the lottery, that concept, has infused maybe a little bit more interest in some of the draft? I don't know if it's the periphery. It works for other sports, I guess. It invigorates and energizes the draft process. But from a brass tacks standpoint, do you think the clubs are liking this?
I think it gives opportunities to someone like the Braves, right, who maybe not necessarily having a down year this year and have the chance to potentially get a really high-end draft pick next year. It gives other teams the chance to really alter their franchise in one day. And that's something you didn't really have. You could rely on the Rockies, right, picking number one for the most part, or the Nationals picking one for the most part the last few years. But what you do now is you have the chance for other fan bases, other teams who maybe just had a single down year and quickly can turn it back around. You want to give them that chance as well, and it doesn't necessarily prioritize and favor teams that are obviously tanking, which is a huge problem, and we've seen it across sports all along. But it just gives other teams, other fans a chance to really get excited about the draft. Just the idea right now, if you look on Twitter and you look at Braves fans right now, they're like, oh, okay, the season might be lost, but, you know, we have the chance to pick potentially top three next year. And you see them already talking about college baseball next year.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it?
It is pretty crazy. But I think it's good for baseball. They still have to find a way to make it work. They still have to find a way to make it work so that you can really de-incentivize tanking. But for the most part, I do like the change, and I like the way that you can necessarily give other teams a chance who might, like I've already said, who might have had just a singular bad year and could use some help immediately.
Yeah, now the Braves, if you look at their bonus pool, they're not working with as much money as the top clubs are. If you're curious about this, biggest bonus pool is owned by the Orioles at just over $19 million. The Braves, meanwhile, You can track back about $10 million off of that total. They got $9 million. It's not nothing. I'd take it and be happy to walk away with it, but they're not offering it to me. But it does make it interesting to see how much do you spend for the particular slot that you have at number 22. And then something the Braves have done is maybe get that guy under slot and use some of that money to entice maybe a prep player away from a college commitment. I would imagine that's going to be something the Braves and really every club is thinking about as well with regards to the bonus pool.
No, absolutely. And one of the more recent rumors that has been going around have been these high school agents have come and said, have tried to tell their players that they should prioritize signing with a major league team at a lower cost. And so you do have that really good chance of going under slot in the first and then having the money to be able to sign some of these really projectable players later in the draft with a more manageable amount of money.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this calculus all works out. The Orioles have the most money, if you're curious, again, over $19 million. Mariners at just over $17 million. Angels just over $16.5 million, just ahead of the Nationals at about that same amount. The Rockies, $15.7 million, and the Marlins also have $15 million to work with. That's the top six. I'm not going to go through all 30 teams, but just to give you an idea, and the Braves have just over $9 million. They have the same amount as virtually the Dodgers, the Cubs, the Giants, the Phillies, actually a little bit more than the Phillies, the Astros, Padres, Mets, and the Yankees have the lowest amount. And some of this obviously has to do with a host of other things that we don't have time to get into that costs you draft pool money that probably shouldn't be affiliated with it, but we'll leave that there. We'll have something to talk about another time. He's Gaurav Vadak of Baseball Prospectus. We've known each other for a long time. It's always great to sit down, chat Braves, and now draft with you. Let folks know where your work is and how they can follow along with everything you got going on.
Yeah, absolutely. You can find me at Baseball Prospectus. I'm the director of marketing over there. And if you want to talk all things Braves, I'm also on Twitter at GVDAC. And then, of course, I write for Battery Powered.
All right. Well, a lot of places that you can catch him. It feels like the same story I tell people. There's a lot of places you can catch me as well. Gaurav, I know you're busy. I'm looking forward to heading over to the draft and enjoying some time to see what the Braves do and break it all down with you on the other side. So thank you for making some time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thrilled to be here.
All right. Well, we have a busy night ahead of us and a lot more Braves baseball and draft and all-star things to talk about as we continue with From the Diamond. We'll turn our attention back for a few more Braves stories in the first half, and we'll get back into the draft as well. It comes your way next on From the Diamond with Grant McCauley on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game and the Odyssey app. Welcome back into From the Diamond with Grant McCauley on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game. We are live from Murph's, just like the man said. We are counting down to the MLB draft, which is happening this evening. It begins with the first round at the Roxy. The Braves are picking number 22 overall. And as you just heard from my conversation, there are a lot of different directions that they could go. Ultimately, what will they decide? Will they stick with what they know, which typically seems to be drafting a starting pitcher? Or will they branch out and maybe look at position players? And I joke because I know they do look at them. But ultimately, I think it's a really good point that Gaurav Vadak just made from a baseball perspective of you have to go with the best player available on your board. And that board can change based on what the other teams are doing before it gets to you. And the Braves are going to have to pick after 21 other selections have been made. So it will be interesting to see what they decide to go with ultimately. But we also know that with the draft, it's a long way to the majors for most of these players, though there are some notable exceptions. One of them, we'll talk about a little bit more later, is already pitching in the big leagues and has been since last summer. And that, of course, is Paul Skenes, who's going to be starting for the National League, second consecutive year for him to draw that start. So a lot of excitement going on with that as far as getting to the big leagues fast and being able to really showcase your talents. And there's another pitcher that we're going to get into a little bit later who got himself an opportunity to pitch in the All-Star game or make the NL squad. They caused a little bit of controversy. We'll dive into that when we take our trip around the big leagues here in just a little bit. But let's talk about a few more Braves first half topics. And I think there's just no way around the elephant in the room for this club at this point, which is where exactly are some of the pieces going to be going at the trade deadline? Are they going to be going anywhere? Will the Braves entertain the idea of bringing on pieces? And the only way that's going to happen is by winning a whole bunch of games in a short amount of time. And the 2025 Braves have had a great difficulty in that. And I know that Brian Snitker gets a lot of flack about saying that I believe that this club is capable of going on a run, but history would tell you that the Braves typically, at some point in every single year, go on that run. Now, usually, it's the month of June. Historically, that's been a very good month for them. This year, it was the exact opposite. As they've come into July, that has not been very kind to them either. The Braves have had trouble winning series. They've had trouble winning close games. And that's the kind of stuff that a good team, or a team that at least fancies itself as a contender, has got to be able to do. Consistently win series and consistently win those close games. And it just has not been happening for the Braves. So it puts them in this position as they try to wrap up their first half of their season. A series win against the Cardinals is a nice step. They'll get a few days off. They'll get back in action against the Yankees, a club that has had some ups and downs some this year as well. But, again, to point out, the Phillies have had some ups and downs this year. But if you're 13, 14 games over 500, you can deal with that. When you're 10 games below 500, it becomes a little bit more difficult to be able to, I don't know, manage expectations moving forward. But managing expectations might have been a boat that sailed a long time ago for this club. So I say all that to say, to walk around the subject and now talk about it, is what kind of trades might the Braves be making and who could be on the move? Now, Marcelo Ozuna is one of those guys, a veteran DH who could draw some attention at the deadline for clubs just looking to strengthen their lineup. But the return, I think, is going to be affected negatively by the fact that he's got a bad hip, and that bad hip has very clearly correlated with the drop in production for Ozuna that since basically the end of April has turned him into about a 200 hitter with lacking power and without the run production that he showed so well. And look, Marcelo Ozuna came back from, I think, a depth in his career that not a lot of players are able to get back to and climb to heights that he, I don't think, had previously enjoyed in his career, with the last couple of seasons averaging, 40 homers and 100 runs knocked in, and last year carrying the Braves' offense on his back all season long. But at this point, in that last year of control that the Braves have, with it feeling less and less likely like Ozuna is going to be back in the future, do you entertain that deal? I think the answer to that one is yes. But what can you expect to get from him or for him at this point, seeing as his production has dipped? That kind of hurts, I think, the general expectation of deciding to sell off pieces. Is he more valuable moving him on or keeping him around? Because it is worth at least noting that Ozuna is a pretty popular player in that clubhouse, so it will signal a couple of things. Number one, that his time here is over, and number two, it will leave a void in the overall fabric of the team. But I know I've heard a lot of people kind of questioning, well, what is the fabric of the Braves team? Are they comfortable with all this losing? And I would tell you the answer to that is no. But the personality overall of a team can take a lot of different forms, and it's a little bit different each and every year. I don't think anybody's enjoying, obviously, what's going on, but I think that the search for answers has been the most baffling and the number one thing that the Braves have had to fight against seemingly from day one this year, of trying to figure out where their offense is and how to get their offense going. And losing Marcelo Ozuna would, if nothing else, signal a change for the Braves lineup. And Sean Murphy, we've noticed, here's a segue for a trade talk that's been going on a lot, especially on social media. He's been tearing the cover off the ball. I mean, coming into Sunday, last 11 games, Sean Murphy had 7 home runs and 16 runs knocked in. That's a pretty good run for Sean Murphy. He's obviously going to get some more playing time. We're seeing that with Drake Baldwin, either catching or DHing, and Sean Murphy, either catching or DHing. And based on the struggles of Ozuna, it's hard to not do that at this point and maybe just rotate Marcel in a couple of times a week, at least until you figure out what's going to go on at the trade deadline, who's staying, who's going. But using the hottest bats that you have to the best of your ability, to give them the most at-bats that you can. And with Austin Riley now injured, I think that the search for offense has reached an even more heightened level, because now you're looking at Ronald Acuna Jr. batting third for this club. That's another thing that I would have put on the list of things that, if you're trying it, is probably desperation, and that's probably true. Is it logical to want more run production and look at Ronald Acuna Jr. as a guy that can give it to you? Absolutely. But the shortcomings of so many other players in the lineup have exacerbated this problem, and now the injury to Austin Riley may be the straw that broke the camel's back. We don't know how long he'll be out, but that could be the thing that just really does end this offense if he misses an extended amount of time. You already lost Jurickson Profar for 80 games. Now he's back. Can he be effective at the top of the order in place of Ronald Acuna Jr.? If he is, maybe you are able to start getting a few more runs on the board. Matt Olson has also been swinging a hot bat, so that's been extremely helpful. But you're going to need more than a couple of hitters to get this thing done. Now, not only is Marcelo Ozuna, do I think, going to be somebody that could go somewhere, and we'll see how this all plays out, but you start to look at some veteran pieces of the Braves bullpen and wonder if there aren't going to be some offers on those, because Raisel Iglesias, well, he appears to be Raisel Iglesias again. After a very rough 6 or 8 weeks to start the season, he's managed to turn it on, to look a lot more like himself in recent outings. And that, I think, could have some clubs interested, because he has a resume that obviously goes far beyond just his struggles in early 2025. and it would just be a rental. So what kind of prospect could he get on a rental for Raisel Iglesias if he's pitching as well as he has lately? I think that return, all of a sudden, may have gotten a little bit more tantalizing. Another veteran reliever I think that falls in this boat or under this category is Pierce Johnson, who could be of interest to contenders as well. I think he's been, by and large, maybe the Braves' best reliever this season. I know it may feel like it's Dylan Lee. It might be Pierce Johnson. There's not a whole lot of contenders in this regard. There are a whole lot of questions, I think, for the Braves bullpen as well this year, obviously. And my question would be, who do you turn to if you start to deal off the Pierce Johnsons, the Raisel Iglesias, the Aaron Bummers, if you will, and any other reliever that maybe a big offer comes in for from some club that you just might use to, as we talked about earlier in the show, start to build some quality depth in your farm system, because you're just not seeing that. It's just not there from a position player standpoint to give you alternatives if guys are hurt and to give you alternatives if guys are not performing. And the not performing thing at the plate this year has been the number one thing that has undone all of the Braves' plans. The pitching injuries are one thing, but the not performing at the plate has been a major problem for them. And the Braves are going to open the second half against the New York Yankees at Truist Park. So you'll see the Giants as well, and then a road trip with stops against the Rangers, the Royals, and the Reds. And the deadline is July 31st, so that will be right before that Red series gets started. It's going to be interesting to see where the Braves are when you talk about the, what, 12 games, I guess, running up to the deadline with series against the Yankees and the Giants and the Rangers and the Royals before you get to that series against Cincinnati. Who might be here? Who might be gone at that point? And if the Braves do, for whatever reason, run the table, if you will. And this is a big what if, granted. And it may not be worth the time and the energy that I'm spending coming up with it. But what if the Braves are able to go on a little bit of a run after the All-Star break? Do you look to hold, maybe? I don't know that you want to spend any of your precious assets in the farm buying a bunch of rental players and trying to go all in. I mean, the Angels did this a couple of years ago when they did not trade Shohei Ohtani. Felt like they might have themselves in position to sneak into a wild card berth in the playoffs, and then it just didn't work out for them. But the Braves are run a lot different than the Angels because they have a lot of players under long-term contracts, and that has also been a point of consternation for a lot of fans, feeling like maybe some of these deals are better than others. And, well, look, they were always going to be a little better than others. I think you're happy with what you're getting from Ronald Acuña Jr. I know there has been some conversation about, well, maybe the Braves should explore that. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think that's a realistic possibility. I don't think that they're even entertaining that kind of thing. In fact, I would go as far as to say that's just not part of what they're looking to do. Then you start to move to Austin Riley and Matt Olson. I think those are two guys that are going to be here. You look at the Ozzie Albies deal. There is a decision, I think, to make if you're the Braves on those $7 million options. The question is, of course, who might fill in that spot? And I don't think you've got a clear answer to that because of the problems down on the farm with having somebody ready to go in that regard. Michael Harris is kind of at a crossroads of sorts in his very young career because he's got to figure out whatever he can to get back on track offensively. And he doesn't have the answers to it. I don't have the answers to it. Nobody has the answers to it. But he's going to have to grind it out and figure it out. I think that swing decisions are a big part of it. There's just no way around that. But he's another guy that's signed to be here for a long time, as is Spencer Strider. And then, of course, we come back to Sean Murphy. I know that the Braves, watching him do what he's doing this year and having a Drake Baldwin, could be tempted to trade Sean Murphy. It would make sense if they did on a number of different levels. And the number one level is, are you going to get a big return for him? If that is the case, then I think it's going to be conversations and talks that are worth having. But you can also look at it on the flip side as you've got one of the best catching situations in baseball by having Sean Murphy and Drake Baldwin. And if Marcell Ozuna is no longer in the picture, maybe you're able to do what people have suggested that you do and DH one and catch the other and maybe have that third person in there that's kind of part of the bench, maybe a proven veteran hitter that can help give those days off, because you're going to have to give both of those guys actual real days off. You can't play 162 for Baldwin and 162 for Murphy between catcher and DH. It would sound great in a vacuum, but in terms of how tough that job is behind the plate, you've got to have somebody else in there. And if you're not spending $16 million on Marcell Ozuna and you've got Sean Murphy under contract for his, what, $13, $14, $15 million, and then you've got Drake Baldwin at close to the league minimum, and you're able to find another useful hitter that you can get at bats for and to, maybe this whole thing would work out. And you just change the math around just a little bit. But the bottom line is, you've got to figure that out with Sean Murphy, with Drake Baldwin, but you don't have to do it at the trade deadline. I guess that's my point. And I really don't foresee him being one of those guys that the Braves would move in season. And they have been hesitant, and Alex Anthopoulos has flat out said, look, we're not trading the guys that we have on the multi-year deals. And that will be true unless or until they need to trade him. And he has always said, and this is the part that I think gets lost in the Alex Anthopoulos long-term extensions conversation regarding the lack of no-trade clauses, is they've never really been in a case where they have to yet. They certainly weren't going to sign guys and then trade them. That would be bad. If you sign guys and they play a number of years under that deal and performance becomes an issue, well, then yes, it's a possibility they can be traded because this is a business and that's how it works. But I'm just not sure that that's the kind of stuff that's going to be happening prior to the trade deadline. So it'll be interesting to see the different levels to which the Braves will trade players away, sell players, and what levels they might do some buying, if any buying this year, and then, of course, where that takes them into the winter. But as far as the first half is concerned, it's left the Braves in a very unfamiliar territory, and that is one of potentially being a seller, something that not a lot of folks, I think, were planning on or thinking about when this season began. When we come back, we will take our trip around the big leagues. We will talk about some all-star stories going on. We'll take a trip back in time for a all-star debut that happened in 1948, and we'll talk a little bit of home run derby as well with some of the players involved in that. That comes your way next on From the Diamond with Grant McCauley on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game and the Odyssey app. Welcome back into From the Diamond with Grant McCauley here on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game as we are enjoying the All-Star festivities going on at Truist Park in the Battery. A very busy few days is ahead of us. The Home Run Derby, of course, happening on Monday. The All-Star game itself on Tuesday. The MLB draft, though, happening on Sunday night. So if your dance card wasn't full of baseball stuff, well, all I can say is couldn't be me, because I got plenty of stuff to get to over the next 72 hours. Then maybe there'll be some sort of break before the Braves and the rest of baseball comes back and the regular season resumes on Friday. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. Instead, let's take a look at some of the biggest stories from the week that was. And we'll start out with some All-Star related news. And maybe the biggest piece of that this week revolves around a young, hard-throwing pitcher named Jacob Mizorowski of the Milwaukee Brewers. He was a surprise addition to the National League All-Star squad, but if you've watched him pitch, you can certainly understand why he has All-Star written all over him. Mizorowski is 4-1 with a 2.81 ERA through five starts this year. That's his entire resume, not just for the season, but for his career as well. But the big arm, his 100-mile-an-hour heat and nasty breaking stuff, that has him piling up strikeouts and got him added to the National League roster. The 23-year-old discussed his surprising news this week with Brewers reporters and, as you might imagine, got a little bit emotional.
Yeah, I mean, I'm speechless. I mean, it's awesome. It's, very unexpected, and it's an honor.
Can tell you're emotional. Yeah. Said you were emotional when you got the news. What are you thinking about to get this news?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's been a long time coming, and, you know, I just want to honor the guys around me and, you know, be a Brewer.
Is in your wildest dreams coming into this season, could you have envisioned something like this happening?
No, not even close.
Now, adding the guy they call The Miz, and that's a whole nother thing for an IP infringement, if you will, but Mizorowski made some history with the fewest career games ever for an All-Star, as he has just the five starts under his belt thus far. Is he one of the best young arms in the majors? I don't think there's any question about that. He's on a very short list, and he's been up for a very short time, so I think that begins to create the question, the controversy, if you will, which was brought to the surface after Mizorowski was added to the National League roster. Did he do enough to jump the line and make the team over other more proven veteran pitchers or guys who simply had a good year? But I guess it just depends on how you view the All-Star game. It is a showcase, after all. So five starts, five dominant starts at that, it got Mizorowski on this team. Other pitchers having done more this season and also having good years, well, they weren't all able to punch their ticket to the All-Star game here in Atlanta. And the Phillies are rather unhappy about their players not getting the All-Star nods. And Mizorowski got the call to join the NL team this week. And given that he has just the five starts under his belt, the reaction was mixed. And I think that's to be expected because of what I just laid out. It's fair to wonder, what do you have to do to make the All-Star team? Are there minimums to what you need to do in order to be named an All-Star?
But again, I think this whole process is subjective. And look, the starting lineups are decided by a fan voting process, which is not exactly the most scientific way to pick the best players. But the Phillies believe that starters Christopher Sanchez and Ranger Suarez were more deserving of All-Star nods because they had done more with their season. It's the quantity over quality debate, or is it the quantity and quality over just some quality with not enough quantity, if any of that makes sense? The Phillies, I will say this, they had themselves a good cry about Mizorowski making the All-Star team. Trey Turner said it is, and I quote, a joke. It is bleeping terrible. I mean, that's terrible, dude. That is not a great quote. I don't really care who you are. Let's go to JT Romuto, who said, this is just how MLB does it now. Nothing against the Mizorowski kid, but those two, meaning Christopher Sanchez and Ranger Suarez, two starters for the Phillies, are deserving of being on the team in the first place. There's no doubt. I would expect that from JT Romuto, and I will stipulate that Sanchez and Suarez are both having good seasons. Nick Castellanos, meanwhile, said, it's turning into the Savannah Bananas. I'm not sure it's quite gotten there, but who knows? The bottom line is, the veteran Phillies player said that Mizorowski's nod cheapens the All-Star honor. Here's more from Trey Turner. Yeah, 100% it does cheapen the honor. I mean, it's not the All-Star game in the sense that the best players go there or people who have had the best season. It's whoever sells the most tickets or has been put on social media the most. That's essentially what it's turned into. Now, the Phillies sent a franchise record 8 All-Stars last year. They have 2 representatives this year. It's Kyle Schwarber and Zach Wheeler, the latter of whom is skipping the game. And the Phillies, to the credit of the organization, did decide to just go ahead and pay Christopher Sanchez his All-Star bonus despite being snubbed from the team. So I guess it's a happy ending for Sanchez at the very least. Now let's hear the counter-argument to this. It comes from Brewers teammate Christian Yelich, who's seen Mizorowski up close and has a pretty good idea of what this kid's capable of. Yelich said, I understand why some people feel the way they feel. It's just because it's a small sample size. But at the end of the day, people want to be entertained. It's a showcase of some of the best and most exciting players in the game, and Miz is definitely that, right? I think he's got a point. I think the Phillies, to some extent, have a point. The way to which they went about making their point, I don't know. It still felt like, even if they put a bunch of disclaimers on it, came off at the expense of Mizorowski, and whether or not that was intended, I think that's the way it read for a lot of people. All right, let's turn the page and get to some happier stuff. How about another All-Star story? Byron Buxton hit for the cycle on his bobblehead day as he's heading to the All-Star game here in Atlanta and participating in the Home Run Derby. It was Saturday afternoon at Target Field, his bobblehead day, and his second All-Star appearance just days away. Buxton turned in one of the best games of his career as the Twins grabbed a 12-4 win over the Pittsburgh Pirates. Take a listen.
For the Pirates pitching staff this year, sharply hit to short, stumbling counter for left, but finds his footing, and Buxton beat it. Now Buxton with a laser to center field, Cruz on the move, and he won't get it. Buxton on his way to third base, triple. A line drive, left center field in the gap, and that is in play. That one hops over the wall, and there's an automatic double. And the 0-2 in the air to center field. Cruz going back. Cruz to the wall. Looks up. It is gone! He's done it! Byron Buxton, a cycle! A seventh inning home run to straightaway center field. The Twins have their first cycle ever at Target Field. And guess who? The All-Star, Byron Buxton!
Well, you talk about a warm-up for the All-Star game and for the Derby. The talent that Buxton has is immense. Unfortunately for him, over the course of his career, the injuries have been immense at times as well. But this year, Buxton hitting .286 with 21 homers and 17 stolen bases in 77 games and heading to the All-Star game here in Atlanta. Another man who can say that is Cal Raleigh, who continues to make home run history, because we can't talk about home runs or the Home Run Derby for that matter without discussing the Big Dumper in 2025. What a nickname that is.
Raleigh, deep left field. Are you kidding me? It's unbelievable. It's remarkable. It is the first half, the likes of which we have never seen from a catcher.
That, of course, is Cal Raleigh of the Mariners. The slugging catcher was added again on Friday. That was the second of his 2 home runs. He launched a grand slam, which breaks the AL record for most home runs before the All-Star break. He's got 38 heading into Sunday. Barry Bonds set the record with 39 home runs before the All-Star break when he hit 73 in 2001. So some pretty serious company that he's rubbing elbows with. But among the things that he has done so well this year, better than any switch hitter in baseball history, as far as home runs before the All-Star break, his 38 is the new record there. It's also a new career high in home runs for him, and he has already matched the Mariners' record for most multi-homer games in a season with 8. It's just been a tour de force for Cal Raleigh, who again will be headlining the Home Run Derby on Monday night at Truist Park. How about another all-star heading to Atlanta is Shohei Ohtani, who is back on the mound and looking great. It took a while for him to get on the mound for the Dodgers, but it appears to have been worth the wait and worth that very sizable contract that the Dodgers signed him to a couple of years ago. The man who is arguably baseball's best player, even when he's not pitching, is back to his two-way exploits. After allowing a run in his season debut on June the 16th, Ohtani has really started to turn it on. He's operating as an opener while building up his pitch count. And keep in mind, no minor league rehab assignment for him either, because he is a very important part of the Dodgers lineup as a hitter. But better and better and better is what Ohtani has looked in his last few outings while using his 100-plus mile-an-hour fastball. He has made 4 more appearances, pitching about once a week right now. 8 innings total, 3 hits, no runs, 2 walks, and 10 strikeouts since that season debut where he allowed a run in his first inning. He has allowed just 3 hits in 28 batters faced. Ohtani looks like he's getting back to his old ways on the mound, and he's just doing his thing at the plate. He's leading the National League with 32 home runs, 89 runs scored, and a .608 slugging percentage, batting .275 this year. He's knocked in 60 runs and headed to the All-Star game on Tuesday. Our next All-Star headline is Paul Skeens of the Pittsburgh Pirates, who has some greatness this year that is just flat-out going unrewarded. He has been one of the best pitchers in baseball since the moment he was called up last summer, and Skeens is going to start the All-Star game for the National League on Tuesday at Truist Park, becoming the first pitcher ever to start an All-Star game in each of his first 2 years in the majors. Skeens leads MLB in ERA at 2.01. He's got 131 strikeouts and 121 innings across 20 starts for the Pirates in the first half. Those sound like All-Star numbers. Unfortunately, his resume is not getting the amount of wins it should because the Pirates have been unable to support Skeens' routinely dominant outings. He has a 4-8 record this year despite allowing 2 runs or fewer in each of his last 17 starts. Pittsburgh has lost 8 of those games, and maybe a team of all-stars is what it takes to score a few more runs and help Skeens out on Tuesday night at Truist Park. One last All-Star story. It's kind of a throwback, if you will, a little bit of All-Star history, because it was this week in 1948 that the great Satchel Paige debuted for the Cleveland Indians. It was July 9th, 1948. After 20-plus years of barnstorming and playing in the Negro Leagues, one of the biggest personalities and best players in baseball history finally made it to the major leagues. Never really sure of what his age was. Some thought that Paige might already be in his 50s when he arrived in Cleveland, but he was officially listed at 42 years old and was the oldest rookie in American League history. All he did was immediately help the Indians capture the pennant in the American League in 1948, going 6-1 down the stretch in 21 games. He spent 2 years in Cleveland, then returned to the Negro Leagues in 1950 and signed with the St. Louis Browns for the next 3 years from 51 through 53 and became an All-Star in 1952 and 1953. After that season, he was released, and he jumped kind of in and out of baseball over the next decade, making some appearances. But in 1965, because the story doesn't end there, Paige signed with the Kansas City Athletics at the age of 59 to pitch 1 single game, and he did that on September 25th, 1965, against the Boston Red Sox. Keep in mind, nearly 60 years old, Paige allowed 1 hit and threw 3 scoreless innings at the Red Sox that day. That just one of the many legendary tales of Satchel Paige, who was elected to the Hall of Fame in 1971, becoming the first Negro Leaguer to be voted into baseball's Hall. And I saved one more little piece of business for last, because who wants to argue with the umpires? Well, apparently nobody does, but they also don't want to argue with the ABS system and maybe don't even want to bother with it. You can count me among those who are surprised to see that the ABS system may not be quite the hit that everyone's hoping, at least not yet, in this version of it. Now, in the All-Star game on Tuesday, the ABS system will be available. If you challenge, you have two of these. If you're right, you retain your challenge. If you're wrong, you lose your challenge. If you lose both of them, they're just done for the day. So there's a lot of tactical thought, I guess, that has to go into this. So while it is being used in the All-Star game, according to one longtime baseball reporter, this is still not popular technology with the players. Let's get the explanation from ESPN's Tim Kirkjian as to why this would be.
The ones that I've talked to and others in the game feel like the players don't want the responsibility and the accountability of being in charge of a challenge on a ball or a strike because they worry, do I know the strike zone well enough in order to be in charge of a challenge? And what if I challenge in the second inning and we lose a challenge? I had a major league manager tell me this year that in spring training, he thought the overriding point was that most players realized the umpires are better than they think, meaning a hitter goes, there's no way that's a strike. And then they run the replay and it is a strike. That's my feeling that a lot of the players look at it and not sure they're confident enough in their understanding of the strike zone to be in charge of a challenge system. They want somebody else to do it for them, but the manager can't do that, and the manager shouldn't have to do that.
Okay, now based on that, I do totally understand it because the challenge system, again, is a weird way to do it if we're looking for perfection. But then again, is that what we're looking for? Or are we just looking for consistency? I think most people would probably sign up for the latter, but I'm not sure that Major League Baseball's challenge system is necessarily fully formed, if you will. But as we know, these things have a way of evolving, and perhaps this will just be the latest and greatest piece of technology, or maybe it won't make as big a difference as we've all been assuming that it will over the past few years. That being said, I'd still like to see it, and there are some umpires on some days that I just can't understand how they could be so wrong so many times. But with that said, we'll see how the ABS system plays out on Tuesday, and of course beyond that, when Major League Baseball looks to incorporate it more fully. But that will do it for our trip around the big leagues for now. We'll be back with more All-Star and Braves talk here on From the Diamond with Grant McCauley on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game and the Odyssey app. Welcome back into From the Diamond with Grant McCauley on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game as we continue ramping things up for the All-Star game and, of course, all of the festivities that are going on at Truist Park, the Battery, and the surrounding area. And we wrap up the first half for the Atlanta Braves, who are closing out business in St. Louis before the break. Of course, for a very long time, when we thought about the All-Star game, it was about a month and a half after the Major League Baseball draft. That is no longer the case, as the last couple of years we have seen the draft has been folded into the All-Star festivities, and that is happening on Sunday night at the Roxy, as all 30 teams will get ready to select the players they hope will guide them into the future, and the Braves are one of those 30 teams. They have the number 22 pick in the draft, and we're going to talk all about that, the draft strategy, the minor league system, and more with Matt Powers of Battery Power. He joins me right now on the WadeFord.com hotline. Matt does a great job covering the draft, has done a ton of legwork already for it. You can find all of his work at BatteryPower.com. You can also follow him on social at MattPowers31. Matt, appreciate you making some time to join the show on what I know is a very, very busy day and a very busy week. It's certainly a time that folks look forward to see who the future stars of their team could be as their name gets called for the MLB draft.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. It's definitely one of my favorite times of the year, getting to see this farm system that we follow all year round. This is really the big chance that we get to see it add new names, because those international names that they add in January really aren't seen in the U.S. until the next year. So this is really the one chance we get every year to see the farm system grow.
Yeah, it definitely is. And that international thing we'll get into a little bit later, because these obviously are, I think, two sides of a coin when it comes to player development. The Atlanta Braves, though, have the number 22 pick in the first round, and the strategy has been to take pitchers with their first pick. They went with a prep pitcher last year in Cam Caminiti, which I think was a little bit of a departure, at least on the pitcher side of things. But obviously a high-ceiling arm. Most first-rounders are high-ceiling players. The last time they took a position player, though, was catcher Shea Langeliers, who was traded to the A's in the Matt Olson deal. So I guess I'll ask you the question everybody asks themselves every single year. Are the Braves expected to take another pitcher first, or is that just kind of like asking you if you expect the sun to come out each day?
I think it's kind of a tough one this year, because what they're linked to this year, the players they're linked to, are a little bit of a heavier on the pitcher side. They are definitely linked pretty heavily to one hitter that I like as well, Josh Hammond, the shortstop who's probably going to end up playing third base out of a North Carolina high school. But they are typically linked to more pitchers. There's also some other high school shortstops they're linked to, a little less than Hammond and some of the pitchers like Gage Wood, Crew Schoolcraft, Patrick Forbes, Tyler Bremner, of course. But if you look at just the mock drafts, it does lean heavily towards pitcher. I don't think they're set on that. Who's even going to be available on the board out of that group of names is also a question mark, which could impact where everything goes. I mean, I think based on the way that the draft board sets up, what I've heard, just the traits of these players, I'm guessing Bremner would be the number one guy on the board for them out of this group of players. He's also the least likely to be available. After him, you wonder if Hammond might even be the next guy. I don't know that for sure, but the traits that he has, very much like Austin Riley when he came out, I think I even comped them together. Just the two-way player who profiles as a hitter, move to third base, likely power over hit. It's a profile the Braves have liked in the past. A guy like a Gage Wood who kind of has some health concerns with shoulder this year, along with a lack of innings in his career. Also, his stuff, the secondaries, have not really led to being slam dunk starter pitchers just yet, even though they have shown flashes of being there. And a kid like Crew Schoolcraft, a 6'8", two-way player in high school out in Oregon, that's most likely going to pitch. He's got massive upside, but you're talking about 6'8", two-way pitcher from a cold weather state, which obviously those 6'7", 6'8", and up pitchers just have that much harder of a time adjusting mechanically, command-wise, though his command is actually pretty solid. But he also is probably going to be one of the more expensive options as well. He's definitely one of the guys who's really looking to get paid in this draft, and there are some teams that come up behind the Braves that are in on him that have quite large bonus pools.
Yeah, and obviously the bonus pool will play into it somewhat because you have to be smart about how that money stretches across all the rounds of the draft. And I know obviously a lot of prospects to parse through, as you just mentioned, quite a few names there, and who might make sense at that pick is of course going to depend on who's available and the strategies of the other teams ahead of the Braves. I asked about that tendency to draft pitching, though, because it is obviously what the Braves have shown themselves to do more times than not. On the flip side of the coin, I was talking about earlier, Atlanta's hoping to sign toolsy, talented position players through the international pool, and that hasn't really worked out so much in yielding the high upside or big hype prospects that we're hearing all about, top 100 type guys just yet. Do you think that it is worth revisiting the strategy to look for hitters in the traditional draft as opposed to maybe leaning so heavily on the international side for where they've been getting their hitters, at least in recent years?
I think some of that in recent years in the draft is partly because of best available. I think last year, a lot of the names that were being focused on by the Braves heading up to the draft were actually hitters. But then Cam Caminiti fell to the Braves, and he was widely expected to be gone maybe a dozen picks before the Braves even got on the clock. Once a guy like that drops, you just can't pass on him. Just kind of like Bremner this year, even if they were focused on Hammond, which not saying they would be, it's just hard to pass that talent up. And I think the year before, it was probably actually going to be a hitter as well, but it sounds like Waldrop was the best available player on their board at that time. I mean, I didn't fully buy in on that at the time. They did leave some very talented hitters on the board there, but if that's what your internal draft board says, you have to go with that. They have gone fairly high with some hitters, taken some chances, spread some money around guys like an Isaiah Drake, Nick Montgomery, who are all still pretty young, but Drake Baldwin just before that. So I think in the first round, they're more open to going hitter than what their draft record suggests. They definitely have more confidence in their player development, working with pitchers and scouting as well, because that's where they've had such great success. And finding pitchers on the international market is just almost impossible because they're signing at 16 and coming to agreements at 12, 13, 14, 15 years old. So it's easier to project hitter traits at those ages, but I think they lean pitcher overall. not specific to this year, but are definitely more open to hitter than what their track record suggests.
Yeah, should be intriguing. As you just mentioned, you never know how the draft board will come together and how that picture will start to come into focus based on other players being available that maybe you didn't think would be there. So a great point about Caminiti last year, especially chatting with Matt Powers of Battery Power. He joins me on From the Diamond with Grant McCauley on the WadeFord.com hotline. Let's talk a little bit about the farm system in general, 30,000-foot view. I think we can all agree it's no longer one of the higher-rated in baseball, and it's been that way for a few years, which is typically, I think, something that comes along with teams that start to have a lot of success at the big league level. They don't get to draft as high. They have to be more creative, and it's a little bit more difficult to get to, I think, some of the top talent, perhaps, in some cases, at least that first-round talent. But Alex Anthopoulos hasn't really parted with a lot of great young prospects in the trades that have come back to haunt this team. If you look at how he got Chris Sale, Matt Olson, Sean Murphy, even Raisel Iglesias, where he did take on some money. Of course, all the work he did at the 2021 deadline was not at the expense of a lot of high prospects either. It's been interesting to see how the Braves have utilized their talent, even though they haven't had a highly rated farm system, to routinely go out and fill the needs they have at the big league roster.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think they haven't had the highest rated farm system in about 5 years or so at this point. But what they do with their farm system is they are consistently able to produce guys, whether it's pitchers or hitters, that actually fit their needs and come in and fill holes up in the system. I mean, heading into this year, you could have said the same thing. And Drake Baldwin has become one of the most consistent hitters in the lineup. Before that, at times, even though he hasn't quite lived up to that this year, Michael Harris has done that. AJ Smith-Shaver, who wasn't even a high pick, even though he did come in over slot. I forget whether that was the sixth, seventh, or eighth round a couple years ago, but they're good at getting players that are going to make an impact for them. Even though the system itself isn't that strong, especially in the upper levels, especially hitter-wise. But, I mean, you look and see J.R. Ritchie, and Owen Murphy, who still hasn't pitched yet this year as he returns from injury. But guys like that, there's still plenty of talent there in the mid to upper levels. Plenty of talent down in the lower levels from Augusta on down, especially guys like Diego Tornez, who's down in the DSL this year and has really looked promising. But even though the system isn't highly rated, there's definitely a lot of talent in there. Worth watching.
I think it's sometimes it's subjective. I've talked to a lot of people around the game and around the team that would say, okay, all those prospect rankings that we read, those are nice. And I think that they are a general guide for a lot of people who are just trying to keep up with who's in the minor leagues. But it's not necessarily how the clubs evaluate their own talent internally or how they evaluate the talent that they scout. And you make a great point because we've seen the prospects that come up and make an impact for Atlanta. Michael Harris II, Spencer Strider, Spencer Schwellenbach, Drake Baldwin this year, William Contreras even. I mean, these are guys that in the last 5 years have come up and made a difference, even when the farm system was sliding in those rankings. So there are some impact players still there. I guess the next question would be, what do you think the system needs to start kind of trending back in that direction as far as depth is concerned? You talked about the lower level of the minor leagues, maybe having more of that readily identifiable talent, but just not close, not knocking on the door right now. This organization hasn't necessarily been able to yield, I think, the kind of results they've liked to in quantity, at least, even if there has been some quality mixed in there.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think once their system is able to spread talent around a little bit better to the upper and lower levels, their lower levels are definitely packed with talent, but the upper levels do lack that. I think if they were able to get the kind of talent they have in the lower levels to the upper levels while keeping that kind of talent in the lower levels, once you're filled with a bunch of high upside and even low upside guys that can contribute on the big league level, that's when you start to get into the conversation as at least being middle of the pack to better teams.
Well, let me ask you a two-parter here. Number one, if you had a lean on who the Braves are looking for in the early portion of the draft, particularly the first round, guys they've got an eye on. I know you said the board can move around. I think we all know that there are some moving pieces to it. What do you think would be the ideal pick for the Braves from where you're sitting?
I think Tyler Bremner would probably be the ideal pick, the guy I personally want to see them take most. I mean, a college pitcher, which obviously can move a little bit faster. He's got huge stuff, three pitches, and also a great feel for command. guy who could possibly be a frontline starter. But if he's not there, maybe I'd say Josh Hammond would be the guy I'd personally like to see them take most. He would be another guy that goes into the lower minors, obviously, as a high school pick, but just continue to add another bat with talent to a team that can use more of those. But there's still plenty of names. Guys like Cruz Schoolcraft is another guy with massive upside. And if we're looking beyond just the first round, guys like James Ellwanger from Dallas Baptist is a name. Michigan high school pitcher Lee Fernsler. Aaron Watson, a school arm out of Florida. So there's plenty of arms and bats out there in the later rounds. And there's definitely a number of shortstops that they've been linked to, high school shortstops, because that's the strength of this entire draft, bat specific demographic. But I think they definitely grab one. They've been tied to Jaden Laurie from Arizona, a high school shortstop out of there, as a possible overslot kid.
Should be interesting to see who obviously they take in the first round, but all the rounds after that, and how creative they can get maybe with some overslot signings that could yield some talents that might have otherwise been ticketed to go play in college. So we'll see how it all plays out, Matt. I think the most important question I can ask you, though, is because I know how much work you guys have been putting into this. Where can we connect with all your draft coverage, and how do we keep up with everything you've got going on?
So I'm on Twitter at MattPowers31, and I have a new Substack that I started, which is ncaabaseball.substack.com.
All right. Well, it sounds like a lot of great information is coming our way. Obviously, the draft is going to be a whole lot of fun, and we'll see which way it falls beginning on Sunday night as the draft will take place at the Roxy in the Battery, as if we didn't have enough stuff going on. Matt, I know it's a busy, crazy week for you. Appreciate you making the time for me. I look forward to talking with you again soon.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you for having me.
All right, well, that was Matt Powers of Battery Power. Appreciate his time, and that is going to wrap us up here at Merce at the Galleria on From the Diamond. The Braves, meanwhile, head into the All-Star break. They are going to take a little bit of time before they get back in action. That's going to be happening on Friday when the New York Yankees come to town. But Truist Park is going to be very busy this week as the Home Run Derby is happening on Monday. The All-Star game is happening on Tuesday. I'm going to be heading to the draft, which is happening here on Sunday. I want to thank all my guests for making their time to come by and say hello at Murph's for From the Diamond. And also want to thank Gordon for doing a great job out here with the live remote, and Dom, of course, back in the studio for keeping the show going. I've been Grant McCauley. This has been From the Diamond. I will catch you next week. And until then, so long, everyone.